Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for our daily magazine show, As It Is, and other programs designed for English learners.
Hello and welcome back. I'm Jim Tedder in Washington with the program that helps you learn and improve your American English. We do this by speaking a little more slowly than normal, and we use words that are easier to understand. 7 days a week, we tell you about interesting and important events happening around the world. If you are hearing us only on the radio, we urge you to try to find a computer and print the script, the written words we say, on our website. Then download the audio as a podcast and save it. That way you can go back again and again to read along with us and practice saying the words in the American style. Okay, let's get started. Today we begin with information about how Americans feel about the ongoing fight against terrorism. A national survey finds that twice as many Americans approve than disapprove of the U.S. military campaign against the so-called Islamic State. The Pew Research Center in Washington, D.C., published the survey. Researchers found that 63% of Americans support the campaign against the Islamic State, the group also known as ISIL or ISIS. Anne Ball has more.
Carol Doherty is director of political research for the Pew Research Center. He says now nearly half of Americans are willing to consider sending ground forces to fight the Islamic State group.
Equally important, you see growing support for the possible use of U.S. ground forces to deal with this threat. 47% favor the use of ground troops now.
Mr. Doherty says that number is up from 39% since last October.
A significant shift, and given that the public has long been wary of using U.S. ground forces in conflicts around the world, 47% is a pretty sizable share of the public supporting that view.
But Mr. Doherty says support for ground troops could change if sending American soldiers becomes more of a real possibility. U.S. government officials have not yet formally debated sending American ground troops to fight in Iraq and Syria. There is a partisan or political divide on the issue as well. Republicans are twice as likely as Democrats to support the use of ground troops to fight the Islamic State militants. 67% of Republicans support using ground troops, but only 32% of Democrats do. Democrats are three times as likely as Republicans to say they are concerned that the U.S. will go too far in getting involved in the fight. Some Americans are wary after years of fighting wars in Afghanistan and Iraq.
While there's a clear desire to stop this group, there's also this nagging, lingering concern over yet another deep, long-term U.S. involvement in the region. And that concern is particularly felt by Democrats more than Republicans.
Researchers took the survey in February after Islamic State militants released videos of horrific murder scenes. Those videos show more than 20 Egyptian Christian men beheaded on the beach, and a Jordanian pilot burned alive in a cage. Earlier videos show Islamic State militants beheading Western and Japanese hostages. Mr. Doherty says the survey shows Americans know about these stories and are reacting to them.
Americans have been seeing a steady stream of just horrific acts by ISIS, between the beheadings and other atrocities. And, you know, the news reports about the growing power of this group, and the public is reacting to it and saying that, you know, more needs to be done to stop ISIS.
In February, the media reported that another Islamic State hostage, 26-year-old American Kayla Mueller, died in Syria. The public does not know how she died. Pew researchers found that most Americans still support the U.S. government policy of not paying for hostages held by terrorist groups. James Comey is the director of the FBI. He says the U.S. government is following 150 people suspected of terrorist connections who traveled from the U.S. to Syria. On February 25th, authorities arrested three men in New York and Florida who, they say, have connections to Islamic militants. And in Minnesota, a threatened attack against the Mall of America has increased Americans' fears of another terrorist act on U.S. soil. I'm Anne Ball.
You are listening to As It Is, the English Learning Program from VOA, the Voice of America in Washington. The U.S. Supreme Court is the highest court in America. It has now heard opening arguments in a workplace religious discrimination case. The justices are considering whether a clothing store can deny employment to someone for wearing a religious head covering. Marcia James takes the story from there.
7 years ago, Samantha Eloff sought employment with the clothing store company Abercrombie and Fitch. At the same time, she was a 17-year-old with a love of fashion. She seemed the perfect candidate for the job. Miss Eloff went to her job interview wearing a religious head covering called a hijab. She says she was denied employment because of it. Eric Baxter is a lawyer with the Beckett Fund for Religious Liberty. He is leading the legal action in support of Miss Eloff.
She could not remove her headscarf for a job interview without remaining true to herself, and Abercrombie refused to hire her because she was true to her religious beliefs.
Abercrombie and Fitch says it did not object to Samantha Eloff's headscarf for religious reasons. It says the headscarf does not meet the company's dress code for employees. Zainab Chaudhry went to the Supreme Court to support Ms. Eloff. She says she understands the difficulties of wearing a headscarf.
You never know if, you know, the reason that you aren't hired for a job is because of the hijab versus something else. I have had prospective employers ask me questions about my faith, about my background.
Yolanda Rondon is a lawyer with the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee. She says if the court rules in favor of the company, it could permit all employers to discriminate against people of any faith.
They'll be able to not hire persons they perceive of a religious faith they do not like or does not promote their brand image.
The Supreme Court will rule on the case in May. I'm Marcia James.
And I'm Jim Tedder in Washington. You are listening to VOA, the Voice of America.
Coming up, more programs designed for English learners. You can read and listen to our reports and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
From VOA Learning English, this is the Education Report. Today, we return to the subject of successful public speaking, centering on the physical message of presentation. Some call this body language. Charles LeBeau is a professor of public speaking and has written several books about how to do it well. Mr. LeBeau tells VOA that body language includes posture, eye contact, and gestures, how you move your hands or arms.
For the physical message, I think a lot of non-native presenters are going to have problems with posture and eye contact and gestures. And I think a lot of this comes from nervousness. Not only are they nervous because they're doing a presentation, but in addition to that, they're really nervous because of their English and their lack of confidence and lack of experience in their English.
One effect of being nervous is moving from side to side. A presenter does not need to stand perfectly still. In fact, an audience can lose interest in a speaker who does not move. How a speaker moves is important. Whole body movement should be slow and planned to command attention. Such movement helps to communicate confidence. New public speakers know that they should look at the audience while they speak, but they look at their notes on a paper or at a screen if they have an electronic presentation.
Having notes and trying to talk from notes often is a big problem, so they have trouble with eye contact.
Charles LeBeau says the best way to avoid this problem is to use images and few words for notes instead of sentences. The image should help communicate the point you want to make. Writing a few words with the image on your slide helps you remember that point. Then you can look at the audience while speaking.
The images will communicate faster and more clearly than the words.
Holding on to notes also makes it more difficult for a speaker to gesture naturally. Mr. LeBeau's book, Speaking of Speech, discusses this. He says gestures should support the point the speaker is making. Other experts advise moving your body to a different place for each idea. Stay in place until you finish making that point, then move to the next place on the stage or in the room. Mr. LeBeau says a good way to change your body language is to make a video of your presentation and watch yourself. This helps you to become aware of what you need to change.
I find oftentimes the gestures don't look natural, they're poorly delivered, or they're just non-existent. Students can video themselves and then look at it. They can clearly see, oh my, I had no idea that I look like that. I think that helps them change more quickly.
An important part of public speaking is practice. When you practice, remember these important tips. Be aware of your posture, eye contact, and gestures. Record yourself using a phone, tablet, or camera. Watch yourself and plan what you will do to improve. Look for opportunities to speak and gain more confidence. Mr. LeBeau says his students find the physical message the easiest thing to change in order to become a better presenter.
It's the easiest to change and maybe the most important thing to deal with first.
In our next speaking tips, we will look at the visual message and the story message. I'm Jim Tedder.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. The 1880s were years of important change in American business and industry. 20 years after the Civil War, the United States had become one of the leading industrial nations of the world.
As the number of factories increased, so did competition between businesses. Some industrialists cooperated with their competitors to reduce competition. But this did not always succeed. There was no legal way to enforce their agreements. This week in our series, Leo Scully and Jack Weitzel tell how these issues were handled during the administration of President Benjamin Harrison.
In 1879, a new form of business organization was developed, the trust. In a trust, stock owners of many competing companies give control of their stock to a committee or group of trustees. The trustees operate all the companies as one and pay profits to the stockholders. The profits would be high because there would be no competition to drive down prices. One of the first trusts was formed by John D. Rockefeller in the oil industry. The stockholders of 77 oil companies gave control of their stock to 9 trustees of Rockefeller's Standard Oil Company. The 9 men controlled 90% of the nation's oil production.
The success of the Standard Oil Company led to the creation of trusts in other industries. Soon, there was a sugar trust, a salt trust, a steel trust, even a whiskey trust. These huge corporations represented hundreds of millions of dollars. This great wealth made them very powerful. Former President Cleveland, himself a friend of business, warned of a growing danger. Corporations, he said, should be carefully controlled creatures of the law and servants of the people. Instead, they are fast becoming the people's masters.
The public began to demand government controls of the trusts. Farmers claimed that prices were too high, and they blamed the trusts. Workers said their unions could not negotiate with the new industrial giants. Small businessmen charged that trusts were too powerful. They said the trusts could destroy them. Public demands for action led the governments of 15 states to pass antitrust laws. But the state laws could do nothing. Most of the trusts were nationwide corporations, which did business in many states. Public protest was so great that both parties in the 1888 elections promised to pass a federal law against trusts.
A number of such bills were proposed. One, offered by Senator John Sherman, a Republican, was approved by Congress. President Benjamin Harrison signed it into law in 1890. The Sherman antitrust law sounded severe. It said it was illegal for a trust or any other organization to interfere with interstate commerce, trade among the states. It was also illegal for any person or organization to form a monopoly, to get control of a whole industry. The law ordered harsh punishment for any person found guilty of these crimes. It sounded like a strong law, but it was not. It was written in a very general way that left the courts to decide what the law really said. Opponents of the Sherman antitrust bill said its purpose was not to destroy trusts, but to make the public believe that trusts would be destroyed.
During President Harrison's administration, only 8 corporations were accused of violating the new antitrust law. Of the 8, only 1 was found guilty, and only in a very limited way. The first company charged was the Whiskey Trust. A court dismissed the case. It said the government failed to prove that the trust had interfered with interstate commerce. A few years later, the government asked the courts to break up the huge sugar trust, which controlled 98% of the sugar-producing industry. The Supreme Court refused to do so. It said that it was true the trust had formed a monopoly in the sugar-producing industry, but it said the monopoly was in manufacturing, not in trade or interstate commerce. Therefore, said the High Court, the sugar trust was legal and did not violate the antitrust law.
Industrial trusts helped to reduce competition among American companies. High tariffs also gave some protection from competition with foreign companies. But business leaders were not satisfied. They demanded even higher taxes on imports to further reduce competition. So, Republican Congressman William McKinley of Ohio proposed a new tariff bill, one that would raise import taxes higher than ever before. The tax already was about 38% on most imported products. The new measure would raise it to almost 50%.
Not everyone in the Harrison administration supported the high tariff measure. Secretary of State Blaine wanted to increase trade between the United States and other countries. He warned that new high tariffs would destroy those plans. Blaine also opposed the bill because he felt it would hurt the Republican Party politically. In a letter to Congressman McKinley, Blaine said the bill would anger the farmers by adding as much as 8% to the price of shoes for their children. Such movements as this for protection, said Blaine, will move the Republican Party only into speedy defeat.
Most Western and Southern congressmen opposed the tariff bill because it would mean higher prices to the people of their states. But the bill could not pass without the support of some of them. So supporters of the tariff bill offered a deal. If Westerners voted for the tariff measure, then Eastern lawmakers would support a silver purchase bill that the Westerners wanted. The bill, known as the Sherman Silver Purchase Act, would have the government buy 4.5 million ounces of silver each month. The government would pay for the silver with paper money, treasury notes, which could be exchanged for gold or silver money.
Western mines were producing huge amounts of silver. By selling it to the government, the mining interests hoped to keep the price of silver from falling. Western interests spoke in Congress now with a much stronger voice. In 1889 and 1890, six Western territories became states. This added 12 more Western representatives in the Senate and others in the House. The deal was agreed to. Both the McKinley Tariff Bill and the Sherman Silver Purchase Bill were approved by Congress and signed by President Harrison. As expected, the price of imported goods rose, and the people blamed the Republicans.
In the congressional elections of 1890, the Republican Party suffered heavy losses. The Republican majority in the Senate was cut to 8, and not all the Republican senators would support the party on every issue. The Republicans lost control in the House of Representatives. Only 88 were elected to House seats. Democrats elected 235 representatives. Voters also elected 9 House members and 2 senators from a new political organization, the People's Party. The new party was born in farming areas of the West and South. It was a party of protest, formed by men who refused to support either of the two old parties.
Years before, farmers had united in agricultural organizations they called granges. A national grange had been formed. During hard times, the grange organized political action groups to help elect officials who were friendly to farmers. But as farm conditions improved, the granges began to disappear. A few years later, farmers began to build new organizations. Like the granges, they began as social and economic groups. By the late 1880s, many of these groups had united into 2 large organizations. One, with more than 1 million members, was the Southern Alliance. The other, with fewer members, was the National Farmers Alliance. Members of the 2 groups began to unite for political action. And that will be our story on the next program of The Making of a Nation.
Our program was written by Frank Beardsley. The narrators were Leo Scully and Jack Weitzel. You can find our series online with transcripts, MP3s, podcasts, and images at voaspecialenglish.com. You can also follow us on Facebook and Twitter at VOA Learning English. Join us again next week for The Making of a Nation, an American history series in VOA Special English.